This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Flooding, drought, and wildfires are happening all over the world. Why? And why did scientists leave out models showing extreme warming? UK expert Ranjini Swaminathan takes us inside the future forecast machine. Then we revisit ecofeminism. U.S. Green Party founder Charlene Spretnik and Susan Griffin on women and nature, speed, consciousness, and quantification. That's from the Forum in Chicago, Techno-Utopianism and Fate of the Earth. This is Radio EcoShock. As global temperatures go higher than expected, why did official science avoid models suggesting higher than expected temperatures? Does that matter for big impacts like flooding, drought, or wildfires? What drives them? We get a flurry of questions from a humble paper that at first glance appears to be a discussion among experts on climate modeling. Fortunately, we have the lead author to explain. Dr. Ranjini Swaminathan is an expert in climate modeling at the University of Reading. Yes, she has published on cognitive robot systems and pattern recognition, but she tends to ask real questions affecting billions of people. How can we think about a very different future? From Reading, UK, Ranjini Swaminathan, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, Alex. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk about my paper on behalf of my co-authors. Thank you.
Well, it's great to have you here. And your group studied regional climate drivers for things like fire and monsoon flooding. Very important, always hits the news. Is there really any global climate change, or is it all a collection of interacting regional changes?
That's a good question. And the short answer is yes, there's definitely global climate change, and that's a certainty. And this global climate change, as you are already aware, is primarily due to greenhouse gases, the chief of them being anthropogenic carbon dioxide emissions. This global climate change, though, manifests itself in different ways at regional scales or local scales. So some areas can have like excessive warming, some can get colder in the winters, some areas might have exacerbated droughts, some have more floods. So this is all part of the system and often driven by this warming, global warming. So if you have to think about it slightly more technically, the global warming can be considered as a thermodynamic change, so that's the thermal response to warming, whereas these local changes are more reliant on what are called dynamics of the system. So they depend on circulation, for example, like while this carbon dioxide forcing, as scientists call it, which is global, may not change from, you know, between yesterday and today. I live in Edinburgh, and if the wind blows from the north, that circulation, right, essentially that will be colder than if it blows from the south. So that's an example to kind of contrast the global versus the local change.
For the past few decades, experts and institutes have struggled to build Earth system models. How should our listeners understand the current best level of climate models?
Right. The current generation of climate models, or the state-of-the-art models, are also called Earth system models, and that's because they have these coupling across systems for domains, like you have a land model, an ocean model, and a model for the atmosphere, and they're all like coupled together. But they also have what's called an interactive carbon cycle. So carbon moves across these domains. And we are currently in, and most of these, well, all of these models pretty much are part of what is called the Coupled Model Intercomparison Project. So the abbreviation for that is CMIP. And we are in the sixth generation of these models. And these models support important reports such as the IPCC assessment reports by providing the underpinning science for these reports. Now, these models have quite advanced capabilities. They're scientifically very advanced. And we have also seen significant improvements across generations of models. So if we just look at the current sixth generation, as I said, and, you know, and compare it to the fifth, there are some significant changes in things like how ocean biogeochemistry is represented, Indian monsoon modeling, atmospheric circulation over Europe. So these are like some examples from the literature of, you know, where people have analyzed these model projections and seen that scientific advancements have been made. Having said that, though, these models still have challenges. So due to computational constraints, these models operate at spatial scales of like 100 kilometers or thereabouts, which means that they are not the best really at capturing processes, like some of these dynamic processes that I said, which occur at like, you know, fewer kilometer scale. So that's something that we kind of like have to address still. Another example, I talked to you about the carbon cycle, right? So you know that plants take up carbon dioxide, but they're also very sensitive to temperature. So if it gets very hot due to the warming, they will reduce their uptake of carbon dioxide. So how much they take in, how much that reduces, these are all not necessarily governed by physical equations, right? So these are all harder to model. So we do still have challenges in climate modeling. But overall, the scientific advancement is quite good.
One of the problems to solve, how much heat compared to pre-industrial times will be experienced for a given level of carbon dioxide in the air? And one standard that's been used is what to expect if there's twice as much carbon dioxide, say 500 or 560 parts per million compared to pre-industrial, whenever that occurs. How would you explain the difficult-to-understand debate about so-called Earth climate sensitivity and the refinement of that used in your paper?
So you might have heard in the news or in reports about this term called ECS. So that stands for equilibrium climate sensitivity. And scientifically, what that means is that it's the warming response when you double carbon dioxide, like you say, compared to pre-industrial levels, after the climate reaches an equilibrium. Now, to get that value, it will take thousands of years of model simulations for the climate to attain that equilibrium and for us to get that, which is computationally very expensive. So what we do instead is we use a proxy called effective climate sensitivity, and that's calculated from about 150 to 120-year simulation, but it uses a slightly different experiment. It's called the abrupt 4x carbon dioxide experiment. But in the scientific community, it is well understood that these are very close values, so that it's a very acceptable proxy, and it's close enough that you can consider them to be the same. The debate as such about this effective climate sensitivity or equilibrium climate sensitivity arose because in this present generation, the most recent generation of climate models, the value of this climate sensitivity was seen to be particularly higher than seen in previous models. So what that then did was it prompted concerns that these models may not be realistic, particularly for like regional impacts. In our paper, we address that, and what we show through two key results is that that's not necessarily the case. So our first key result is that effective climate sensitivity is not universally correlated with what are regional climate drivers for impacts. And we show that by taking up different climate impacts or climate drivers for those regional impacts, and also by looking across different regions in the world. The second finding, the second result that we thought was really interesting that came about is models have what is called internal variability. So what that means is smallest changes in initial conditions can produce slight variations in the model simulations. And at regional scales, these changes have those initial disturbances and changes resulting from that can be a lot more than the global forced CO2 or greenhouse gas warming signal. So that's again the kind of like the dynamical or the small circulation kind of small scale changes. So what we saw that if you take a model, and climate models don't produce just one simulation per model, they produce what's called an ensemble. And if you look at the ensemble, all these ensemble members have the same value for climate sensitivity because they're part of the same model. But the spread in these ensembles often is as large as the spread across models. So what that then means, again, that further weakens this correlation of like climate sensitivity with these regional impacts. So this is another interesting thing that came about. So we hope that this is something that the scientific community and the policymakers and stuff kind of like understand that this is a very nuanced thing, and you know, this debate about removing models based on climate sensitivity is not something that we should do.
And then American scientist Zeke Hausfather published a paper a couple of years ago saying these higher range models should be left out when we're dealing with the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. In your new work, supported by a lot of testing, and you've got a really good group working with you, your team suggests these models should be used. In a nutshell, why?
Yep, it leads directly from your previous question. So, the Hausfather et al.'s paper basically said that, you know, these high climate sensitivity models should be excluded from impact studies. And the underlying reason for that was that these are unrealistic because the climate sensitivities are not what we really expect to see. However, what we look at are, you know, specifically, like I said, we don't look at impacts as such. Like, we're not talking like, you know, what flooding does as such, but we look at the climate drivers for these regional impacts. So, for example, when we look at floods, we look at five-day total rainfall, right, and how that changes and how is that correlated with climate sensitivity. And what we found was that there is no universal correlation. So it's possible that the global warming temperature, which is essentially, it plays a bigger role for certain impacts, but it doesn't for all impacts. It doesn't across all regions, which obviously then means that, you know, we shouldn't exclude these models. They should be included for regional impact studies. And also, as I mentioned, there is quite an overlap in the range of these drivers as we see across models and across inside within model ensembles as well. So again, the point I'd like to kind of reiterate is that a lot depends on how these local scale and dynamic processes are also represented in these climate models. While for some impacts, the global warming or temperature change may be the key factor, it may not and will not be for others, as we show in the paper. The takeaway message then is that, you know, we should include these high climate sensitivity models also. Otherwise, we might actually risk missing out on potential real impacts, which can have serious consequences.
Indeed. And your new work, published December 5th, puts the spotlight on three threats: flooding, drought, and fires. And your paper brings together nicely the various forces enabling these big events that make headlines. I found your summary very useful. Let's take them one at a time, starting with flooding. Why did you pick monsoon rains on several continents as a case study in flooding?
Monsoon rains supply water for more than a third of the world's population, approximately, and often these are populations in developing countries. Monsoon flooding can cause severe damage, right, to infrastructure, to lives, livelihood, crops. They can spread diseases. So as we are seeing an increase in population, there's a need to maintain food and water security. So having a good idea of how severe monsoon flooding will change in the future is really important for these communities and for future planning by governments. So we thought this was a very important impact to pick and consider for our study.
And there's been a lot of debate recently about particles in the air called aerosols and global warming. Talk to us about the role of aerosols in the monsoons, and does that include the infamous smog floating across large parts of India, China, and Indonesia?
Yes, aerosols are complex. I mean, they have a complex effect on monsoon. So we discuss in the paper the contrasting effect they may have, but for the purpose of this interview, I'll focus on the primary thing that they do. So what aerosols do is they reflect away solar radiation. So they actually have a cooling effect on the planet. And in the past, this cooling effect has offset anywhere from 30 to 40% of the warming due to CO2. So you can see that it has a really important effect. Monsoon, the strength of the monsoon is one of the key factors, you know, that's responsible for the strength of the monsoon, is the difference in the temperature between the land and the ocean. Now, aerosols produce this cooling effect, and so that difference kind of like weakens, and so the strength of the monsoon weakens as well. So that's the big effect that aerosols effectively have on monsoons. And the smog over parts of Asia and so on, yes, they definitely play a role. But governments all over, right, particularly in developing countries, they are very invested in mitigating the effect, or like mitigating the smog and the aerosols and like reducing pollution, because it primarily has a huge benefit for people living there, right, for human health. However, irrespective of what all of this does and how this goes, by reducing aerosols, and, you know, mechanisms are already in place to reduce these aerosols in the future, what will happen is that it will lead to an increase in regional as well as global warming, because that cooling effect is taken away.
And there are long-range teleconnections between these big monsoon rainfall systems, but I think it's just too complicated for this radio interview. They are listed and explained in the paper. The point is, there are very large interactive systems at play that arch over continents and oceans, and it's not just temperature increases. Does your paper, though, discount the role of global warming in floods or drought?
No. We definitely do not discount the role of warming in any of the impacts. So warming does play a role. How big a role is what matters, right? So what we want to convey is that global warming or the global temperature change is but one factor that influences these regional climate drivers that are responsible, you know, for impacts. This may not be the most important, the global temperature change may not be the most important factor, but it can be in some cases. So essentially what we're trying to say is that as far as like what climate models do is concerned, it's important to also understand how well they model these local scale processes as well. And that's why we shouldn't just remove any models from a study on impacts or impact assessments just based on this climate sensitivity.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
Dr. Swaminathan, let's talk about drought. Pretty well all the projections show the number of droughts increases in the future, but there are so many factors at work. For example, there will be changes to atmospheric circulation and even the jet stream as the climate shifts. How do you know the sensitivity of climate to greenhouse gases is not the deciding factor in droughts?
Warming does play a role, and as you can see in the paper, that the drought events, so we use a metric for droughts, and we see that there is an increase in the future pretty much across models. The primary effect that this warming has on droughts is something called evapotranspiration, which is essentially evaporation plus transpiration. So that's basically water drying up, right? However, where, when, and how often drought occurs matters more on, or depends more on, local processes, with circulation being key here, and that's a dynamic process. There are also other things like how the land, atmosphere, and vegetation interact, and that plays a role as well. So what our results show, that excluding these factors and looking just at the climate sensitivity, shows that it has no correlation to the drought metric. So this is clearly evidence that other factors must be considered for an impact or a metric for drought.
And likewise, with a chorus of other published science, you find fire weather days are projected to increase in the future. We have to be careful here, because last August, for example, there were loud and official warnings of extreme fire-ready conditions in the Pacific Northwest of North America, but it was quiet for a while as far as fires go. What make wildfire predictions so difficult?
So fire is a very complex thing. There's a difference between fire risk and actual fires, as you've just said from your example. So let's just take a few of the, you know, like why this is complex, right? So there are different factors that contribute to fires occurring. So there's the physical climate itself, right? Temperature, whether it's hot or cold, dryness, how much moisture there is in the soil, what is the speed of the wind, what direction is the wind flowing? So those are some physical climate characteristics. Then there is this need for fuel to burn, right? So what kind of vegetation is there? What is the moisture content of that vegetation? And then there's things like the sources, right, or ignition, or the ability for the fire to get extinguished or spread. Ignition itself can be natural, like lightning strikes, or human-induced. And one study actually found that if you have accessible pathways to, you know, potential ignition points, then there's a higher risk of fire, because people can actually travel and set off fires because there's a way to get to those points. I mean, and these are very hard to model, right? And then finally, there's also the local dynamics, which kind of we're seeing a pattern here, right? So I think a couple of years ago in the Pacific Northwest, the heavy fire season, part of the reason it kind of continued on was because there was a stationary pressure system. And so the circulation there was a factor in how long the fire and, you know, the actual fire lasted for. So how all these factors combine and come together determines actual fires occurring and evolving. With climate model simulations, you can make some estimates. I mean, like, so basically what climate model simulations can tell us is essentially about the physical climate aspect. But some of these other things are much harder. So that's why we have this notion of, you know, like flagging high fire risk days. But actual fires may or may not occur depending on how these factors come together.
As I understand it, and I'm not great with this, but the largest single Earth model project, the Coupled Model Intercomparison Project, or CMIP, chose just 18 models for integration. And I know they were trying for accuracy and projections that would be useful for governments, but they left out models allowing higher possible temperatures. Can you give us examples of models that were left out and maybe should be used, and where are they located?
So the CMIP project itself consists of a larger set of models. So it's about 50 models and from around 50 modeling centers, though each model doesn't necessarily produce, I mean, each center doesn't necessarily produce a model. This is very highly collaborative science. For example, the IPCC AR6 report, so that's this AR stands for assessment report, and we've had the sixth report, which is the most recent one, uses most of these models. So the CMIP models kind of contribute to the underpinning science of these assessment reports. Essentially, that report as such does not decide what models to pick. It kind of relies on peer-reviewed scientific literature. So in those reports, you'll see that more than 18 models are represented. The number 18 is basically models, the number of models we used in our study. And you will see in the paper that that number is not constant across the three different impacts we look at. Part of that reason was the availability of the variables needed to calculate. So I talked about the regional climate drivers. So some of that data was not available across all the models. But we started off with a set of around 20 to 22 models, and we came to this 18. And those models were picked because they captured a wide range of ECS values, because our study was focused on that. And these models were also scientifically different. That is, they came from different modeling centers, because sometimes the same modeling center will develop multiple models, and you won't see too much of a climate sensitivity difference across those. So some of those may just be higher resolution and lower resolution and so on. And we also wanted to kind of have when we looked at this diversity in the models, we wanted to capture maximum diversity. So part of it was different modeling centers. Part of it was also ensuring models that had different component models. So sometimes climate models share a land model or an ocean model, and we wanted to kind of have a breadth across all of this. So that's how we kind of used our expertise to handpick models that was an effective subset, and it captured this variability across models. We hypothesized that if we show that climate sensitivity has no universal correlation across regional impact drivers from data from these models, then effectively we are able to show that across a wide range of ECS values, scientifically different climate models, there is no correlation between climate sensitivity and these regional impact drivers, and that can kind of drive the message home effectively.
Well, given historic damages already, we've seen a lot of disasters. It's easy to be paranoid. Is it possible when it comes to the IPCC that high warming models would be excluded to force agreement to official figures? Or is this just a discussion among scientists trying to get the best possible results?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very valid question. There's the whole reasoning behind why we have these publications saying high climate sensitivity models should not be included in these kind of impact studies was, again, because people felt that this might be unrealistic. But really, as I said, the IPCC, in fact, the IPCC's Chapter 7 in the most recent assessment report actually comes out and explicitly says that no single model should be removed from any study because of climate sensitivity. So in our paper, essentially, we show that this notion of this unrealistic future outcomes is not true, right? So, and I believe that, you know, the scientific community wants to provide robust and reliable science. So concerns should be raised, and these concerns should be addressed in a scientific, rational manner. This science is then used for policy adaptation. It's used by insurance companies. It's used by government, you know, in terms of, like, what models to pick for, like, future assessments and so on. So I feel that this is a really important result, not just scientifically, but also for society. And so, you know, it kind of spans, it goes beyond just the science of model development, is what I think.
We know about machine learning for climate research. I've had a number of authors lately say, yes, we used machine learning in this. Has artificial intelligence already arrived in the field?
Indeed, yes. So machine learning is being used for both climate modeling as well as weather forecasting. It's at different stages in these two things. I would say weather forecasting, the use of machine learning has advanced a lot more than climate modeling. And there are different reasons for that, because for climate models, you have other considerations like the long-term physical stability of climate closures, you know, of energy and things. So those things have to be maintained. So that's part of the reason. But I would say, yes, machine learning has arrived in climate modeling.
And a couple of years ago, I asked an eminent scientist this question: do you foresee artificial intelligence, as it combs through vast amounts of data, generating not just answers that we were looking for, but valid and useful questions that humans have not yet considered? He answered, never. You?
Yeah, that's an interesting question. So I would say that machine learning has the capacity, right? Like, you can comb through vast troves of data and you can recognize patterns. So yes, you can do that. But I would also advise caution, because using machine learning, you can always find patterns. Whether they make sense, that's a different question. So I would definitely not discount domain expertise for climate modeling as such. I think that's definitely a very important component. And you can't just let these machine learning algorithms, like, do everything. And I'd just like to highlight one point. You mentioned combing through vast amounts of data, right? So that data itself comes from models that were constructed using domain expertise and, you know, physical sciences. So, yeah, I just want to point that out.
So by domain expertise, you actually mean scientists?
I mean climate scientists, yeah. Atmospheric scientists, yeah. Yes, indeed, yes.
Ranjini, what got you into this highly technical field of climate modeling?
It was two things, right? So first of all, my background is in computer science. I'm a computer scientist, and my background is using machine learning and AI for natural language processing and so on. But I found that these skills were very well suited for climate model data analysis, feeding back into, you know, like, evaluating models, feeding that back for model development, and using machine learning for aspects of model development as well. So that's one aspect in terms of, like, skill set. But the other was also this motivation, right, and concern for what I think is the biggest crisis humanity faces, right, for our future generations and stuff. So when I got an opportunity to work in this area, I just couldn't say no.
From the University of Reading, we have been speaking with climate model expert Ranjini Swaminathan. She is lead author of the new paper, Regional Impacts Poorly Constrained by Climate Sensitivity. You can find more links to follow up in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Ranjini, thank you so much for spending time with us.
Thank you, Alex.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio. For the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org. This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. It seems appropriate that we are now going to two speakers from the conference, Techno-Utopians and the Fate of the Earth. It was held in New York City on October 25th and 26th, 2014. This teach-in was presented by the International Forum on Globalization and the New York Open Center. It was recorded by Dale Lehman of WZRD Radio. Starting with Charlene Spretnak on The Resurgence of the Real.
And our final panelist today will be Charlene Spretnak. She is the co-founder of the U.S. Green Party and the author of Green Politics, The Resurgence of the Real, Relational Reality, and many eco-social essays. She was named by the British government as one of the 100 eco-heroes of all time. And her newest book, The Spiritual Dynamic in Modern Art, was just published this week. Charlene will be speaking to